This is Phil Farron. And I am driving around per usual. I'm still getting used to this business of not going in to my client. It's just weird. I'm still doing work and we're still doing the thing, and you know, we're just all working from home at the minute because of the construction going on in our offices. Although I did actually run into the Assemblies of God headquarters today for, not yet today, Tuesday for a little bit. My wife's computer had started acting a little funky, and so there is a guy who works at the Assemblies of God headquarters who also does computer repair on the side. Really nice guy. And I had dropped off my computer, my wife's computer, with him on Saturday. That was one of those things that worked out, because my wife had told me Thursday night that she thought her fan had quit working on her computer, and it was giving her some trouble anyways, and so I could have sat down, kind of probably puzzled my way through it, but Jay does such a good job that I just thought, you know, so I got in touch. Well, I was supposed to get in touch with Jay, let's put it that way. And so then I was supposed to, on Friday, swing it by someplace that he would be. And then I got up Friday morning, and that thought was just nowhere in my mind. Zero. And then Friday afternoon, after I'd gotten home and done the thing and blah, 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 you know, I was just sitting there, and Jesus whispered, and he said, computer repair, Jay. It was like, oh yeah, right. So I went in and texted him, and I said, hey, would you have some time? I said, we just need to get on your list. And so he said, sure. He said, I can take a look at it. He said, just bring it by. And I said, well, I said, I will be in town tomorrow morning having breakfast with a friend. And I said, we'll be having breakfast over on First Watch, which is Sunshine and 65. And I said, could I just swing it by your house? Are you north? Are you south? Where do you live? And he wrote back and he said, well, I live at such and such and so. And it literally was like 2 minutes from where I was going to have breakfast. And I wrote it back and I said, well, that worked out well. So anyways, good to know. So I took it by his house. He took a look at it over the weekend. He wrote me on Monday. And I wasn't going to be in town on Monday, but I told him I am going to be in town tomorrow, because I thought I was picking up my grandson from Wings when, in fact, Wings was closed. But I needed to take Aiden in to deliver him to his dad so Aiden could get a flu shot, because the Cox Medical Daycare refuses to take children, even 6 years old, probably, and under, unless they have a flu shot. And the deadline is like November 1st, so okay. So I dropped off Aiden with him on Tuesday and actually ran over to headquarters for a few minutes, and then they got him a flu shot, and then Dustin rushed back to his classes, got that taken care of, yada, yada, yada. So I was in there this week once. It's just weird to look around in our offices and all, you know, the back walls are all torn down and stuff, and they're working on that. But hey, it is what it is. And we're puttering along and getting some things done, and. So that's good. Writing is going fine. I'm actually on track this week. I have one more week of writing in the second writing sprint. In the first writing sprint for book 24, which is the last book in the series, of course, the Windfall series, so that's fun. And I think it's going fine. Everything seems to be on track. We seem to, you know, have enough space to do what we need to do, and not too much space, and I think it'll be fine. still trying to figure out how to give people their heroic moments. But all of that will come. It will all fold into place. So I'm getting feedback now on book 23, and that all seems to be fine. So yeah, puttering along. Spending a non-trivial amount of time at this point thinking about the Still Whispers Machination book. I've got a new analogy I'm working on when it comes to trying to understand what is actually happening with gender and sexuality. So that should be interesting. And so far I've chatted with a couple of people about it, and, you know, seems to make people think and, you know, maybe help us understand a little bit more of what's kind of going on here. Puts it in a different context where you can go, oh. Whether it satisfies people's need for an explanation or not, but, you know, that's up to the person. But anyway, so writing is going good. Costumes are going fine. I really don't have any new costume stuff before the end of the year at this point. I did start looking again at the carnival stuff for Venice. The carnival Venice costumes are just extraordinary. They're just amazing. And I believe they're all supposed to be handmade, and maybe handmade by the people who wear them. That carnival happens in March, so I don't know if I'm going to make a run at that, but the costumes really are amazing. I mean, they're just... So... And I don't know that the raw materials to get it all done would be that expensive. It's just the intricacy. So I started kind of looking at those costumes and see what would be involved in making something like that. So I don't know. It's like 5 months away, but I would pretty much need the entire 5 months if I was going to try to do something like that. I mean, they are extraordinary. So we'll see. Anyways, so costumes, writing, work is fine, all is well. Dustin is now moving into kind of the final test that he has to take, and on them, he's allowed to take them twice, so, you know, if he takes it once and doesn't quite get there, he can come back and take it again after he does a little more studying. So if you think of Dustin, pray for him. He's working on his paramedic. He lives in our rock house with his son, Aiden. And that's who I'm actually going to pick up from the school here in just a few minutes. He's working hard. And so we just have a bunch of clinicals he has to do now. He had a really good clinical with his prefector yesterday. And when they got to the end of the day, the prefector told him, I really don't have anything to add to what you did. You did a great job today. So, you know, things are going well there. Now we just have to get through the tests and see where we are. So that's all going good. All is good. This week, I had started to come across a topic that apparently isn't that new, but it just had never come across my feed before, and yet all of a sudden it started coming across my feed, so I don't really know how that happens. And of course, anytime you have claims that could be potentially disruptive of what is quote-unquote accepted and established science, then there's always going to be the naysayers that are going to say, no, that's not what that proves. That's just all, you know, people don't know what they're talking about. So having known that is the way it is, I went out to YouTube and I tried to find something that was from a non-conservative viewpoint so that I wouldn't necessarily, well, that I would get less skew. And so I did find this topic on a PBS YouTube video. And the title of this topic was "Our Junk DNA is More Important Than We Once Thought." And, you know, my reaction to that was, well, uh-huh. Because the idea of junk DNA has been around for a while. And there was simply a reason that the term junk DNA was coined, and it was that scientists were only finding a few uses initially of smaller sections of the DNA, and there was a whole bunch more. And so instead of just saying, huh, you know, maybe we've got a lot more digging to do, they just kind of wrote some things off. I mean, one of the things that was kind of coming out of this was they had only identified the portions of the DNA that code for proteins. And the mystery was, is that when they compared that to those portions in chimpanzees that coded for proteins, what they found, and you've heard this statistic, is that we, of that type of DNA, we share 99% of it with chimpanzees. There's just not that much difference. So they were like, wow, that, you know, 1%? I mean, just in those few million letters of code, does that define humanity all by itself? Wow. So that moved some people to start looking. And part of all this, once scientists realized that they only knew what a small portion of the DNA did, part of that was that immediately some scientists who heartily believed in evolution jumped to a conclusion. And the conclusion was not that we aren't sophisticated enough in our knowledge yet to understand what these unknown sections do. The conclusion they jumped to was, well, of course it's just does nothing. It's just junk. It's just leftovers. Because evolution says that everything came around by random chance, and all that junk, it's just junk. It's like, you know, most of the DNA is just junk. And so no one had ever really kind of looked at the quote-unquote junk DNA very carefully. And then they decided that they would start looking at it. So genetics as a field, just to do a bit of review, really wasn't until 1953. The iconic double helix wasn't revealed until 1953. And sequencing DNA was slow and tedious back then. So, of course, you know, you can imagine that scientists wanted to feel like they were really making progress. And so they decided that, you know, genes do the work and everything else is evolutionary flutter. That was just an assumption. So, once they actually began to look at the differences, you know, they did find some differences between humans and chimps, like the FOXP2 gene, which is a gene involved in speech and language. And they found that humans do carry a version of it that is mutated in just the right ways to help us articulate complex sounds. But everything was shockingly similar. And they found like 20 to 30,000 genes, and that was it. Now, what's interesting is that a grapes has more genes than that. The water flea has more genes than that. You know, tiny aquatic creatures have more genes than the species that built particle accelerators and space telescopes. So what, why, how can we be so complex with what we've been able to accomplish with so few genes? And how are we so complex when those who are very similar to us are not? So then came the Chimpanzee Genome Project in 2005. And for the first time, scientists could compare the entire genome side by side, human and chimp, letter for letter. And that's when things got interesting. Because while our genes were nearly identical, the regions around those genes, the so-called junk, showed subtle but powerful differences. And lo and behold, some scientists began to think that that junk DNA is probably not junk at all. And they started to think, well, maybe it doesn't build proteins, but somehow it controls how and when the proteins were made. Now, this is very, very important. Because if you have regulation things, now all of a sudden this is very powerful. Because I'm backing into a parking space here, because the very kind teachers at Pleasant View allow me to come a little bit early and pick up Aiden. So that's really, really interesting. And in fact, as they considered to pursue this, they kind of developed this model of genes are the tools in the workshop, but the non-coding DNA, the junk, might be the blueprints, the switches, the timers, the control panels that determine how those tools are used. And those same tools can be, as the said in this podcast, these tools can be used to make a table or a violin. It's all about the instructions. So then in 2006, researchers discovered that about 5% of our genome, though non-coding, was highly conserved across vertebrates. In other words, it hadn't changed much in millions of years. And that meant it was doing something important. Those sections seem to act as gene regulators, tiny on and off switches that controlled which genes activated and when. And when scientists compared these regions between chimps and humans, they noticed thousands that had changed dramatically in the human lineage. And these became known as HAR, human accelerated regions. They were little hotspots of rapid evolution, mutations that seem to rewire how our genes behave, particularly in the brain and the nervous system. HARs hinted at something profound. Our humanity might not lie in new genes, but how we use the old ones. Which, as a sidebar, is a really elegant system. I mean, from what that sounds like, what you have is a substrate of how to build a biological creature, and you have all the basic building blocks, and then what you do is you put a control structure on top of that, and God puts his finger in the dust and breathes into that the breath of life, and man becomes a living soul. But that's not what they said. So, and then there were more. So they said, you know, you think the story could end there, a few genetic tweaks, some brain rewiring, and a handful of regulatory switches, mystery solved. However, in 2022, researchers peeled back yet another layer of the genomic onion. They looked not just at the conserved regions, but at the wild frontier. The unconserved, fast-mutating sections of DNA that everyone still thought were junk. And there, in the vast genetic wilderness, they found something extraordinary. Entire new regulatory sequences, pieces of DNA that seemed to have evolved out of nothing. They called them human ancestor quickly evolved regions, or HAQER, hacker. Scientists, you know, scientists. They like coming up with their little stuff. These hackers were unique to humans. In other species, the same regions did nothing. But somewhere along our lineage, they transformed from junk into functional active DNA. Or, parenthetical note for me, they were never junk in the first place. But, you know. And they were evolving faster than anything else in the genome. So what is this hacker effect? What does it do? They said many genes are linked or involved in the immune system, the gut, and the brain. And they said that combination might sound random, but it actually ties into the fascinating idea in anthropology called the expensive tissue hypothesis. So here's the premise. Our brains are huge energy hogs. So if evolution gave us bigger and more powerful brains, it had to save energy somewhere else. And that somewhere else is our digestive system. Compared to other great apes, humans have relatively small guts, but much larger brains. Evolution seems to have struck a trade-off. More neurons, fewer intestines. The discovery that hacker, that's the gene sections that evolve quickly, help regulate both gut and brain genes fits beautifully into that theory. It's as if evolution was fine-tuning two systems at once, shrinking one, expanding the other, using the newly invented genetic switches. Now, okay, so I've said this before, but whenever I read the word evolution and they say evolution did this and evolution did that, I always just say the design for adaptation did this, the design for adaptation did that, because this is pretty sophisticated. So now they're saying, okay, from junk to genius. So after all this searching, from genes to regulatory regions to fast mutating hackers, what have we really learned? Maybe that our greatest advantage isn't particular gene at all. Maybe it's the flexibility built into our genome, i.e. designed for adaptation. The way our so-called junk DNA can reinvent itself in turning unused code into brand new biological tools. Think about that. The most defining feature of humanity might come from the parts of our DNA once considered worthless. By some. Because they weren't considered worthless by everybody. Because people who are actually think that there is a design in nature that is put there by a creator don't have any trouble imagining that our DNA is a spectacular invention. Nor do we have any trouble imagining that while all of our base systems might share DNA from the animal world, it's quite possible that the designer got the entire world going, and once it was all going and populated with all kinds of biological creatures and plant-based creatures, that he then grabbed the dust of the earth and formed man. And so while man does share much of what is in biological nature, there are new adaptations, there are new changes that were made. So, you know, they conclude this portion by saying the most defining feature of humanity might come from parts of our DNA once considered worthless. It's like your junk drawer at home, this is their analogy, full of old cords, rubber bands, and mystery screws. You never know when something in there might suddenly be exactly the thing you need. Or it's not like the junk drawer. It's like a very sophisticated set of tools that was built into us because God knew we would need them. So they start the conclusion by saying, ultimately, this search for, quote, the gene that makes us human, unquote, turned out to be more humbling than triumphant. Because the closer we look, the more we realize how thin the line really is between us and the animal kingdom. Yes, our brains are large and society's complex, but at the molecular level, we are built from the same alphabet, with the same old tools, just used in slightly new ways. That's both awe-inspiring and grounding. It reminds us that evolution didn't reinvent the wheel, it just rewired the circuit board. Okay. So the quest continues. Even today, scientists are still combing through the genome trying to piece together how these countless switches and sequences interact. How DNA and RNA and environment we weave together create consciousness, creativity, and compassion, etc., etc., etc. Maybe we'll have an answer to what makes us human, or maybe the beauty is that we never will, and that being human means being curious enough to keep asking. Okay, or what makes us human is the fact that we carry the God breath. That all of these switches and all of these updates really exist for only one purpose. And that is to create a biological entity that can actually be a vessel for an eternal soul. And that eternal soul then uses these physical bodies to interface to the world and to do God's goodwill and pleasure, and to be his creative endeavors. Because that's one of the verses that I just love, where it talks about, I think it's in Philippians, I should have looked it up, I think it's in Philippians, for we are his creative workmanship. I heard somebody say that you could say that verse could be translated, for we are his poem. That God is crafting in us lives that show his creative endeavor within us. And we exhibit to the world his love and his kindness and his wonder. And we can only do that because he's configured us in such a way that we can actually interface with the spirit world. And in the process of that interfacing and knowing him, we can manifest things in this world that are miraculous. And they're not just miraculous in a physical way, but they're miraculous in creative ways and in literary ways and in musical ways. And there's just all of these things that we're doing that are ultimately an expression of who God is and how he wants to manifest himself in the world. So it's really interesting, you know? So the next time you hear somebody just say, well, you know, there's this and, you know, that just proves that there's no God. I mean, I don't know that I mentioned, so there is this, my wife has BritBox at this point. And she, one of the shows she watches is called QI. And it's hosted, originally it was hosted by a notable atheist actor. And he told the story at one point about, was it a something? It was a fungus or something that would infect an ant or something and turn the insect into a zombie and then keep it alive as the progeny of whatever this thing was actually ate the insect alive from the inside out. And this actor... from this concluded that there couldn't be a God because a God, you know, who was kind would never invent that type of thing. And when I heard that, I just thought, oh, hogwash. What are you talking about? And the big problem with that argument is that, A, I decide who God is and how he's supposed to manifest himself. And then I assume in my own favor that God is X. And then when I see things that don't prove that God is X, then I tell myself, well, I know so much about the universe that now I can conclude that God doesn't exist, which is just, it's just silly. It's just silly. Because if you consider that God might be a narrative God, and that he might tell stories through his creation, and that he might be more awesome and terrible than I am comfortable believing, we could easily look out into the world, and we could see things that are analogies for other things. For instance, this idea of being infected with something that would eat you alive, inside out, is an analogy. We experience just that as we look at what corrupt ideas can do to the human spirit. And it is just as frightening and horror-inducing as imagining what it would be like to be infected with a fungus that would eat you from the inside out. And God, as a narrative God, might just be giving us those examples so that we can make those connections in our heads and be warned off taking things into our lives that are not ultimately good for us. This is Phil Ferrand. And I have finished driving around, but I'm not quite home. I will be soon, though. Have a great weekend.